Reese at the house as instructed and gone to get a coffee. Reese stood as Cherie approached. Unsure how to proceed, he simply said,
I am so sorry about earlier. About your sister. About all of it.
Cherie studied him, the dark eyes intense, judging him.
I'm sorry, too. As you can imagine, these are difficult times.
I can.
I know. Tuvia told me a little more about your history. I know you lost your family. For that, I am sorry.
Thank you,
was all Reese could think to say.
I can see in your face that the pain is still there. Will it ever go away?
I don't know, Reese admitted. I don't think so.
I don't think so either. Why don't we go inside?
Cherie showed Reese to a modest sitting area in the living room. Sliding glass doors led to a small deck overlooking a lawn, the property quickly dropping off in a steep hillside that Reese couldn't help but think would offer the kids a wonderful area to explore in the years ahead.
I work in a winery now,
Cherie offered.
It's not far. I help manage the books for accounting and tax purposes. The money isn't bad. It lets me contribute, and it gives me a break from the kids. I love them dearly, but it's a lot for one person.
Having your in-laws next door must be helpful.
Oh, it is. And I am so grateful. Without them, we'd be stuck in a small apartment in Tel Aviv, and I'm not sure how we'd survive. But they are getting older. One day it will just be me.
The kibbutz isn't really what I expected, Reese said.
Most visitors expect it to be some dusty, cultish commune. They have visions of the black-and-white photos of men and women toiling in fields and training with World War II-era rifles, eating in a shared dining area, and sending the kids off to communal sleeping areas each night away from their parents. It hasn't been that kibbutz for almost a generation.
It reminds me of a gated private community in the U.S., Reese said.
I can hardly remember the U.S. I was young when we left. Aliyah remembered it. When we were kids, she would tell me about the beaches. I still have photos of us in Florida building sandcastles. Maybe one day I'll go back.
Though she was beautiful like her sister, there was an edge, an intensity simmering just beneath the surface.
Why did you come here, Reese? You came a long way just to tell me that she died doing what she did for us, which I don't believe. She could be a selfish little bitch sometimes.
All I can tell you is that when she thought she was dying, those were her thoughts. She wanted you to know that she was doing it for Israel.
And did you believe her, Mr. Reese?
I did.
Cherie studied him.
What happened between you two?
She was a friend in a time when we needed each other.
Spoken like a lover.
That we were not.
Being married would not have stopped her, you know. The job. For Israel and all.
Well, it's good to know I was different. Cherie paused. Even though tired and bloodshot, her eyes still radiated a probing strength. They were searching.
Why else are you here?
I thought I owed it to her.
You didn't.
I did.
Why else? Are you looking for answers?
What do you mean?
Answers as to who she was?
Maybe, Reese said. I don't know. I wanted to pass along that message. How you interpret it is up to you. Now I'm looking for anything that can help me find her killer.
Ah, now I see. You are here for you, not for her. You are no different than those who keep this death machine in motion. Just down this road are villages and people who want to push Israel into the sea. There are mothers and fathers teaching their kids to love, and there are mothers and fathers teaching their kids to hate and to kill, teaching them that the Israelis are subhuman, rats and monkeys in need of extinction. PLO, Islamic Jihad, Iran, they pay the mothers of suicide bombers for their sacrifice, for their contribution to the cause. They celebrate the deaths of our children in the streets.
How do you stop it? The cycle.
When the men and women on both sides love their children more than they hate their enemies, then maybe this can stop. Until then, my kids, Aliyah's kids, they will end up doing their part to keep perpetuating the violence. Eventually we all return to dust, Mr. Rhys. That is the nature of things.
I don't know if Falia would agree with you.
Oh, no, she was too busy doing her part. And where did it get us? Nowhere.
In the end, you may be right. I'm still going to find who killed her.
How valiant,
Cherie said, the cynicism clear in her tone. I'm not going to take much more of your time. I said what I needed to say. My condolences are sincere and heartfelt. Rhys paused. I would like to ask, did Alia ever mention a connection to Syria or Russia that concerned her?
A work question? No, she never talked about work with me. After all these years in the Mossad, I think there would be a line of people wanting her dead. That's how this game is played.
I'm sorry for your loss, Cherie. I truly am.
Losses, Mr. Rhys. Everyone around me is dead, and they were all doing it for Israel.
She paused, then continued.
Forgive me. I do not want you to leave on a bad note. I do appreciate you coming here. May I offer you a glass of wine before you go? It's from the winery where I work.
A peace offering?
Perhaps.
Then I accept. Rhys smiled. I think Alia would like that. Cherie stood and walked into a separate kitchen area. Rhys took a breath and moved to the glass doors overlooking the valley. The sun had long since set, and sparse lights dotted an adjacent hillside. Rhys wondered what it had been like to grow up here during the wars of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Wars that had never really ended, in a time when Israel had proven that she could stand up to the military might that surrounded her, that she could fight and would never allow her people to be lined up and forced into gas chambers. The shadow of the Holocaust still loomed. Rhys heard Cherie enter the room and turned, expecting her to be holding two glasses of wine. Instead, she held a Galil rifle and was pointing it directly at James Rhys. Chapter 32. Rhys had faced the working end of more than a few rifles in his time, but never a Galil. The Israeli-made weapon was an AK-type rifle that used the Finnish RK-62 as its jumping-off point and utilized the iconic upward-turned charging handle. From the curvature of the magazine, Rhys could tell this was the 5.56x45mm version, the Galil SAR compact carbine.
Cherie? You come to Israel, to Golan, to pay your respects. You say you were not her lover. Then why come all this way unless you feel guilt? Unless you are responsible for her death?
She stood about 7 paces away. If she wanted to kill you, she would have already shot. Cherie, listen to me. I might very well be responsible for her death. We don't know yet.
We?
U.S. and Israeli intelligence.
Intelligence?
Cherie spat out the words in disgust.
Just another word for targeting an assassination. My husband, Aliyah's husband, and now my sister, all dead. Good intelligence, bad intelligence, it doesn't matter. It all revolves around death. Your time will come too, Mr. Rhys.
Death comes for us all. It's nothing to be afraid of. It just is.
It will, Rhys said calmly.
The kids next door, mine and Aliyah's? This is what they will know,
she said, shaking the rifle in her hands.
Killing and death. Our neighbors will not stop until every last Israeli is dead, and in turn, Israel will never stop defending itself. There is no end to war.
You may be right. Those kids have experienced enough loss. They deserve better.
They do, Mr. Rhys,
she said, flipping the rifle to safe.
Now go. Go and never come back. You are a harbinger of death. I want you nowhere near my children.
The bullet that took Cherie Galin to the ground was one of a full volley that turned her front door into splinters. Chapter 33. Rhys instinctively hit the floor as bullets cascaded through the door and windows, the more solid wood exterior walls absorbing much of the barrage.
Cherie!
He yelled, low crawling toward the downed woman. As he reached her, he heard voices outside. Farsi?
Arabic, Hebrew, win the fight. Not stopping to check her status, Reese ripped the Galil from her hands and rolled into the prone position as another burst of automatic fire, focused high on the quickly disintegrating door, ripped overhead. Reese flipped the selector to semi, aimed at the voices he heard coming up the steps, and pressed the trigger.
Nothing. Israelis often don't have one in the chamber.
Reese racked the upturned charging handle just as the first man entered. Acquiring a solid sight picture through the hooded front sight, Reese sent 8 rounds of 5.56 into his chest. The assaulter fell forward onto his knees and then toppled face first onto the floor. The second man did not have time to adjust, his momentum carrying him into the room, directly into the fatal funnel and into Reese's sights. A round from Reese's rifle caught him in the mouth, taking his lower jaw with it, his hands dropping his AK and going to his throat as the bullet took his ability to breathe. Reese sent another through his right eye, which blew off the back of his skull, taking much of his brain with it and dropping him straight to the deck. A third man adjusted and moved to the left side of the door. Seeing the movement, Reese rolled to his left to get the angle and stitched him up the side from his hip to his upper chest. As his body contorted around the wounds, Reese sent another into his brain.
How many rounds did I fire? How many rounds are in this magazine? 28? 30? 35?
Reese heard more yelling and confusion outside, followed by headlights and the sound of vehicles on the street.
Reese,
he heard Cherie whisper, her voice weak. He turned his head to assess the situation. Cherie was down and down hard. He turned his head back to the door. The engines and commotion outside suggested that their attackers might be regrouping, so he pushed himself to a knee and moved to the wall, hitting the light switch off. A lamp on a nearby table was on, so he ripped it from the wall as he passed, sending it crashing to the floor where it shattered to pieces, putting the room into darkness. He grabbed Cherie under an arm, hearing her grunt in anguish, and dragged her across the floor to the base of a stairway in the corner.
"Where are you hit?"
Reese asked, frantically looking up and down her body for signs of an entry or exit wound.
"Don't worry about me. Get next door."
"Are they after me? Targeting Cherie? Will running to the kids just draw the enemy's attention in that direction?"
"Take a breath, look around, make a call," Reese heard the voice of his old troop commander advise.
Reese took a breath.
"Prioritize and execute."
"Cherie, is this the only rifle in the house?"
"No. My husband's is upstairs in the closet in my room. First door on your right. In a green duffel."
"Ammo?"
"There are a bunch of magazines in there."
"Loaded?"
"They should be."
"Okay," Reese said.
"Please, please, protect my children."
"Where are you hit?"
"I'm not sure. I can't feel my legs."
"Cherie, look at me."
He looked into her eyes, eyes that had once been filled with fire.
"I want you to take this rifle," he said, handing her the Galil. "Anyone comes through that door, I want you to put bullets in them until they are dead. Understand?"
"I understand."
"Good. I'm going to high ground. Can I see the grandparents' house from up there?"
"You can. You can see it from my room."
"Okay, I'll let you know if anything is happening there. From this position, you can see the front door and the back deck. They might try to come up from down there, so keep your eyes open."
She nodded.
"Okay, stay strong. I'm going up."
Reese was taking a step when he heard a new sound. Reese turned back to Cherie. They had both heard it before.
RPG!
Chapter 34. The rocket-propelled grenade detonated against the outside of Cherie's home on the second floor.
"Take that shooter out, Reese."
He took the stairs two at a time in the dark, his eyes growing more accustomed to the gloom.
"Top of the stairs, only one way to turn, first door on the right."
Reese entered a small bedroom with large windows that overlooked the walkway leading from the road to the house. Curtains were partway drawn. He could see vehicle headlights maneuvering in the darkness and hear voices in the street below over the sound of the intermittent siren.
"You have one priority, win this fight."
Reese went to the closet and flung the door open to find clothes on hangers and shoes on the floor, with a few shoeboxes stacked in the back.
"Green duffel, where are you?"
Reese reached in and threw a suitcase out into the room.
"There, green duffel."
He reached in and slid out the old canvas duffel bag. Fumbling to find the zipper, he managed to get it open and pull out the Galil. Another 5.56 by 45 SAR. Reese briefly thought of the two identical Bravo Company rifles he and Katie kept in the Montana cabin. It made sense to have interchangeable magazines when fighting as a team. Apparently, Yonatan and Cherie were on the same page.
No magazine.
Reese flipped the side-folding buttstock into position, a feature borrowed from the FN-FAL para, and pulled back on the upturned charging handle. No round ejected, but the action felt smooth, exactly as designed. The Galil was ready for business. Reese fished around in the bag and pulled out a magazine. He pressed down on its top and was relieved to find a cartridge. The spring on the Stoner 63-inspired magazine gave only slightly, indicating that it was fully loaded minus one or two. Reese remembered a Buds instructor bringing his personal Galil out to the island, San Clemente Island, for the third phase of Buds, and giving the students in Reese's class a brief on Israel's July 1969 raid on Green Island by Flotilla 13. The class sat entranced by the story, which had only recently been declassified. The 20-man Israeli force had emerged from the water and killed almost every Egyptian soldier on the heavily guarded island. Even though the Israelis used AK-47s and Uzis on the raid, their Buds instructor wanted to highlight the Galil, as it was a rifle the students would likely not see again. It had remained a favorite of Reese's ever since. Reese locked the magazine into place and reached over the top to rack the charging handle. Pushing the selector to safe, he removed four additional magazines from the bag before moving to the side window. A light burned in the grandparents' home next door, but there were no signs of movement or disturbance around their yard. What did the citizens do when they heard an air raid siren? Reese remembered his friend Gavi Friedson telling him about his days volunteering as a medic with United Hatzalah, running to bunkers as the rockets rained down, the Iron Dome intercepting the incoming projectiles in the night sky.
Did homes in the kibbutz have bunkers?
Reese had seen earth-covered cement bunkers outside of homes at various points throughout the day. He flipped the front and rear Galil iron night sights into position and moved to the top of the stairs.
Cherie!
Nothing.
Cherie!
He said louder.
I'm here, Reese.
Looks clear next door. Reese grabbed the railing and bounded down the stairs. How are you feeling?
I'm okay.
She did not look it. Here are two magazines, Reese said. Cherie took them and set one down on the landing, removing the partially spent magazine and placing it on the first step before inserting the new, fully loaded one.
IDF, we all serve,
she said. I want to check your back, Reese said, attempting to run his hands down her spine to look for an entrance wound.
No, you get upstairs. Promise me, Reese. Promise me that if you see anyone approaching that house, you will kill them.
I will.
I don't hear them talking anymore. Go!
Reese raced upstairs. High ground, get to high ground. What is the enemy doing, Reese? Outthink them. He entered the room and took an angle on the windows. The street was dark. They had turned off their headlights. What was next? The enemy had taken casualties and knew there was armed resistance in the house. How many were out there, and what was their next move? He paused to assess his surroundings, ensuring that he wasn't backlit. Always improve your fighting position. Reese crept forward and unlocked one of the four windows that overlooked the grass front yard and the street. He opened it slowly. If he shot, he didn't want his first rounds deflected off target by the glass. He had learned that lesson in Iraq. Would they notice the open window? Possibly. Movement. A man running across the lawn from the street. Friend or foe? In combat? You have to make split-second decisions based on incomplete information in a chaotic environment that will stay with you for the remainder of your life. Was the man running toward the house a neighbor coming to help or an enemy combatant? Reese's mind processed the vehicles in the street, the dress and weapons of the men he had killed downstairs, the Israeli-made weapon in his hands, and the AK in the hands of the man in his sights. Reese pressed the trigger. He noted the reciprocating charging handle rocking back, ejecting the spent casing and loading another round into the chamber. Reese pressed the trigger again. The man vaporized in an explosion that blew the glass from the windows and sent shards flying inward.
S-Vest!
Reese's face felt wet, his vision blurred.
What the hell is going on?
He wiped the blood that obscured his vision from his face and turned his head to check on the grandparents' house, just as it took a direct hit
from an RPG. Chapter 35. Holding pressure on the cut above his left eye to stem the flow of blood, Reese moved to the door and called down the stairs. "Cherie!" Reese heard the sound of an engine and looked back out the window as an SUV skidded to a stop in the road, its headlights illuminating three vehicles in front of Cherie's house. A Land Cruiser 300 series.
"Tuvia!"
Reese saw the door open and a figure sprint into the darkness as the vehicle began to take fire. The high beams lit up the enemy and took their attention from Cherie's house.
"Nice work, Tuvia."
From 75 yards away, Reese moved to the window and used the frame as a brace to further steady himself. Usually a sniper wouldn't want that exposure, but in the dynamic environment of combat, adaptation was king. He found the front sight in what little ambient light was available, calming his breathing and heart rate as he settled in for a shot.
"Don't stay here long, buddy, but make them count."
He held the front sight center mass on a man shooting at Tuvia's truck and pressed the trigger. He quickly came back to the target, finding a second sight picture and pressed the trigger again. Both bullets found their mark and sent the man to the ground. RPGs, Tuvia's vehicle, the S-Vest, explosion, chaos.
In chaos, there is opportunity.
Reese found a man taking cover behind a vehicle, settled the front sight on his head, and sent a round through his skull. Brain matter exploded onto the person behind him. Surprised by his comrade's sudden exit from the land of the living, he stopped firing at the Land Cruiser and looked up at Reese, just in time to take a 5.56 round through the bridge of his nose. He thought of the park just hours earlier, the laughter and smiles, his vision of Lauren and Lucy by the swing set.
"You have to win this fight or you all die."
Reese caught movement in his peripheral vision. A figure was running across the lawn from the flank. The SEAL sniper adjusted his rifle to engage.
"Tuvia, Cherie is going to kill him if he comes through the door."
"Cherie, Eagle, coming in."
"What?"
she yelled back upstairs.
"Tuvia is coming in, don't shoot."
Reese found one more target in the road and put him down before the Land Cruiser's lights were shot out and the enemy focused their attention back on Cherie's house, on the sniper in the window. Reese fell back into the room as the rifles below took aim at the second floor.
"Tuvia!"
Cherie yelled.
"It's me,"
he heard Tuvia say as he pushed his way into the house.
"How many people are out there?" Reese wondered. "It doesn't matter. You need to kill them all."
Chapter 36. As rounds flew into the upstairs bedroom, Reese bounded down the stairs. Tuvia was leaning against the wall next to Cherie. He was holding his right side.
"Tuvia, you hit? Let me see it."
"Negative, I'm good. Leaking a bit, but good."
He had a Glock 17 in his left hand, his right palm pressing against his ribs.
"Reese, I heard a hit. Where? Where?"
Cherie demanded.
"I'm going to check on them," Reese said, deflecting the question.
"Tuvia, she's hit in the back, non-ambulatory. I didn't get a good count on what we were up against out there."
"I saw three cars,"
Tuvia said, his voice raspy.
"I think at least five, six, seven, maybe more."
"Who are they?"
Cherie asked.
"I don't know. Syrians, Iranians, Hezbollah."
Cherie turned her head and spat on the floor.
"Listen to me,"
Tuvia said to Reese.
"Your mom is inbound. They were staged close by. They were shadowing us. They're on little birds and a Blackhawk, but the RPGs may have grounded them. We just have to hold until they get here."
"What?" Reese asked. "Your mom?"
"Katz and my former unit commander thought it best to have a team standing by, just in case. We need to hold."
Another barrage of automatic rifle fire tore through the home, passing by Reese and the two Israelis protected in the corner of the staircase landing.
"ETA?"
Reese asked.
"Unknown."
"Okay, Tuvia. You stay with Cherie. We don't know what's out there, and we might not have much time."
Reese tack reloaded the Galil to make sure it had a full magazine. He handed it to Tuvia, along with the partial and the other full magazine from his pocket. "Hold this," he said. Reese went prone and low crawled down the stairs from the lower landing and continued across the floor, being careful to stay beneath the windows. When he reached the man he had shot eight times in the chest, he pulled his arm through the canvas sling that attached the Kalashnikov to his body. Now he had an AK. Still on the ground, Reese pushed the body over and took the magazines from the dead man's chest rig, two in each back pocket and two in each front pocket.
It would have been too much movement attempting to take the chest rig. Reese noted that the man was in civilian clothes and was not wearing body armor, helmet, or night vision. Nor did he have radio. Interesting. Reese turned and low crawled back to Cherie and Tuvia in the staircase landing area, where he took a knee, confirming that the rifle had a round in the chamber and that the magazine was full.
What are you going to do?
Cherie asked.
What I do best.
Reese looked into her eyes, seeing the fear, the worry. The children. I've got them, Reese said. He bolted into the room and onto the back deck. Slinging the rifle, Reese swung his legs over the railing and used his hands to climb down as far as he could before letting go and dropping into the darkness. Chapter 37. Samir Farzad was getting worried. By his count, he had 7 men down.
Almost at my force. Is the American alive or dead?
Why did the Hezbollah fighter start shooting through the door? That had not been the plan. Samir couldn't ask him. He was dead now. He should have taken all Syrians. They knew what they were doing. But that had not been an option. His Russian employers stipulated that Hezbollah contribute a contingent to include the martyrs. Where was the second one? The first had almost gotten inside. That would have ended it, except for that sniper. Their primary target building had taken severe hits. Their secondary target structure remained dark. They had sent an RPG into it. Still no movement. Samir would concentrate his forces on the primary house. Samir was standing on sovereign Syrian soil. One day Syrian forces would push through and burn every Israeli house to the ground, and Samir would be there.
Mahmoud, he called to his second in command. Get these men organized. Look at them hiding like cowards. Get them online. Soften up the target with the AKs and RPGs. Then get in there and finish the job. Yes, Samir. The men are worried about the sniper. Send RPGs into those upstairs windows. That will take care of him. Yes, Commander. And send Kanti and Basit up on that knoll,
Samir said, pointing behind them.
I want RPGs and a PKM up there to cover both ends of the street. This is taking longer than anticipated.
The RPG-7 was one of the most recognizable and prolific rocket-propelled grenade launchers on the planet. The PKM was really a Type 80 machine gun made in China and based on the Soviet 7.62x54mm R machine gun, but troops the world over still called it a PKM.
Yes, sir. And Mahmoud, find me the boy. The boy? The martyr! It is time for him to prove himself to Allah.
Chapter 38. Abbas Ahmed Marmash hunkered down at the base of a tree in the shadows away from the men with whom he had crossed into Israel. Was the tree a cypress, a cedar, or one of the eucalyptus trees that the traitor Eli Cohen had convinced the Syrian military to plant to give their soldiers shade? In school, he had learned that in the lead-up to the Six-Day War, the Israelis used the number of eucalyptus trees to estimate the strength of Syrian troops. The Israelis estimated the size of their opposition and located the outposts through the trees that stood out in contrast to their surroundings. The eucalyptus was foreign to the Golan. Just another example of the Israelis' duplicity. Abbas's family would be proud. The Israeli dogs and their American enablers had ensured that his people stayed destitute. They wanted to keep all those who swore alliance to Allah under their oppressive thumb. He remembered his teacher writing on the chalkboard of his small classroom,
"The hour will not come until Muslims fight the Jews, so that the Muslims kill them, until the Jew hides behind rock and tree, so the rock or the tree says, O Muslim, O servant of God, this Jew is behind me, so kill him."
Now it was this tree, possibly one planted by the spy Cohen, that would protect him. When he took his finger off the button, he would be condemning his enemy to the fires of hell, where all non-believers went to burn for eternity, and Abbas would be in paradise. He would never feel hunger, never feel pain. He would be remembered as a hero, and his family would have the respect of all those who adhered to the 5 pillars.
Commander Farzad had counseled him to hide until his men had done their job, that he was too important to die like Hassan, who did not make it inside the house.
"Wait until the Israelis come to collect their dead. Wait all night if you have to. Allah will guide you."
Maybe his native Lebanon would construct a monument to his achievement, like the one he had seen at Tyre. The Islamic world had struck a blow that day. It had been accomplished by a 15-year-old Lebanese boy, just like Abbas. He had killed Israelis. His family had been proud. Even now, against the tree in the darkness, Abbas remembered what the plaque had read. "Martyrs create life." His teacher had spoken of this boy with reverence. Soon, teachers across the Muslim world would speak his name with reverence as well. All he needed to do was accomplish his mission. Wait. Be patient. Then take his finger off the button and enter the gardens of pleasure as promised by the Quran. The pills Commander Farzad had given him when he exited the tunnel had calmed him. He had read what was written on the plastic bag when he swallowed them. Zolam. He did not know what that was, but his teacher had told him that he should accept the pills before his mission. They would help him. He was not nervous anymore. He was at peace. And soon he would be at the right hand of Allah, surrounded by virgins. Abbas had yet to touch a girl. He would soon get his chance. Allah would see to it.
"And wage jihad for the sake of Allah, a jihad that is worthy of Him."
"I will."
He thought of his teachers in Beirut. When they heard his name, that it was Abbas Ahmed Marmash who had worn the explosive belt, they would be proud too. They would teach the next generation of his heroism. His legacy was immortality.
Chapter 39. Reese pushed through the darkness, his newly acquired AK at the ready. He had landed in the grasses below the deck of Cherie's home and quickly moved to the base of a nearby tree. He waited a few seconds, listening for sounds that did not belong in the night.
"He who flanks first wins." The enemy knows that too, Reese.
In military doctrine, the keep it simple, stupid, or KISS principle had proven its effectiveness over the ages. When conducting an attack, it was often most effective to align forces on line or in an L. Reese was hoping that the terrain lent itself to the online method and that his enemy had used the street to align their forces. Were they sophisticated enough to have a squirter control element for anyone escaping from their target out the back or to the flanks? Reese would soon find out. Working his way through the shadows, he ran first back down the hill and then diagonally to the house in an attempt to avoid any security elements that the enemy might have set. He moved away from Cherie's house and her in-laws, taking a knee against a cypress tree and watching a neighbor with his wife and children run to a grass-covered bunker in a corner of their yard. Civilians. Innocents. Just like Cherie and her kids. Now they were in danger because of Reese. Or were they? Who were they targeting? What the hell was going on? Later, Reese. Focus on what you can control. Right now, you need to go to work. Reese moved closer to the street in line with the downhill side of Cherie's house. He could see movement in the road but couldn't get a good count at this distance. He could tell that their attention was on the target house. How many were there? It didn't matter. If they took the house, Tuvia and Cherie were dead. Time to go.
Daddy?
Reese turned his head.
Lucy?
The SEAL shut his eyes and shook his head.
Not now, sweetheart. Daddy's got to work.
You work a lot,
the apparition said, echoing a similar sentiment Reese had expressed to his father at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial all those years ago.
I know, sweetie. I have to go now. I'll see you later.
Okay, Daddy. Just remember what you used to tell me.
What's that?
You know, one of your battlefield rules.
My battlefield expectations?
Reese asked, remembering that he had passed on his old commanding officers 4 battlefield expectations, not just to his platoons, but to his daughter as well.
I remember. Which one?
The first one,
Lucy reminded him.
Always improve your fighting position,
Reese whispered as Lucy disappeared in the night.
He did just that, inching closer to the trunk of a thick oak tree. There was a difference between cover and concealment. This tree qualified as cover. The RPG impacted to the front and just to the left of the tree. Had Reese not taken Lucy's advice, he would no longer be drawing breath. The heavy machine gun opened up immediately, the trunk of the tree absorbing the bullets that didn't get eaten up by the dirt in front of it or fly past into the night. Where is that coming from? Muzzle flash. It was coming from an adjacent hill about 50 yards beyond and above the man in the street. Elevated position, automatic weapon, RPG. Someone knew what they were doing. They obviously had a bead on Reese. Before the next RPG hit, Reese had better be someplace else. He glanced at the force in the street standing by their vehicles and saw the confusion in the line. Go, Reese. Move tree to tree, cover to cover, no more than 2 shots per position. The dead men inside didn't have nods. I'm up, they see me, I'm down, Reese thought, remembering one of his early lessons in IMT, Individual Movement Technique, at the SEAL Desert Warfare Training Facility in Niland, California. Reese broke cover and ran forward into the fight. Chapter 40. Samir heard the sound of a passing RPG and instinctively ducked. He expected his security position to fire RPGs at approaching military or police vehicles at the far end of the road to hold them off, not at something so close. Had they fired in error? The PKM opening up into the same area confirmed that it was not an accident. They were being flanked.
Right flank, Samir yelled. Right flank.
Where? Mahmoud yelled back.
Where? Samir turned to his second in command, just in time to see the side of his head cave in. Samir raised his rifle, flipped it to full auto, and pressed the trigger. With his sights in the general direction of the threat, he dumped his entire magazine. As the PKM on the hill opened up again, he dropped behind the front tire of the closest car.
Change magazines and neutralize the threat. You have fire superiority with your PKM in an elevated position. Kill the American!
Samir rose to his feet in time to see a dark shape materialize and then fade into the night.
There!
He yelled at the soldiers left alive on his line.
He is there!
Samir pointed frantically at a shadow moving toward them. The shadow shot again. 2 rounds caught another of Samir's men in the chest. The shadow kept coming. The 3 vehicles had been parked facing different directions.
Light!
Samir ran to the dark Jeep Cherokee, reached inside, and turned on the headlights. Chapter 41. Reese was moving from one tree to the next when the headlights caught him mid-stride. He hit the ground and pulled himself behind a tree that was much too small as the PKM opened up again. They did not have night vision, but now they didn't need it. All they had to do was send a kill team to flank his position while keeping him pinned down with the elevated machine gun.
Think, Reese!
The former SEAL had lost most of his advantages. He was now outmanned, outgunned, his location was known, and they had him pinned from 2 locations. Time was of the essence.
You're fast, James, but even you can't outrun time.
He smiled at the memory of his father. Then he rolled slightly from the prone and tack reloaded. No sense in running to your death with a partial magazine.
Lucy, I might be seeing you sooner than expected, baby girl.
As he pushed himself to a knee, he thought of Nizar Khatan and Freddie Strain's widow.
I'm sorry, Joni. Okay, Reese, shoot and move. Go for those headlights and just keep killing.
He took a breath the same way he had in the starting blocks of the 200-meter sprint he ran in track and field in middle school. His mom and dad in the stands cheering him on. The fastest kid in the county next to him in the blocks, both waiting on that starter pistol to launch them down the track. He thought of Aaliyah and the justice she might never have. He thought of Lauren waiting for him on all those deployments and training trips. And he thought of Katie and the question he would never be able to ask her. Then he pushed out of the blocks, feeling the cold embrace of death. Chapter 42. Samir saw the man drop to the ground and scramble to cover behind a tree. Was that who he had come to kill? The American? It was too difficult to tell with such a fleeting glimpse at this distance. If so, he had just made their job easier.
That machine gun needs to keep shooting. I'll maintain a base of fire from here and send three of my men to maneuver on him. There is no escape for the American now.
As Samir turned his head to order the three men to his right to form a kill team, he caught movement from the American's last position. Maybe the kill team was unnecessary. The crazy American was going to run to his death. Samir raised his AK and heard a crack to his left, then another, and felt the sting of skull fragments and warm brain matter pepper the left side of his face.
What is this?
He looked back at the house and saw two distinct muzzle flashes from behind two of the front windows.
What?
Samir went to a knee behind the vehicle as another one of his men took two rounds to the chest from the aggressor still coming at them from the trees.
Get in the car,
he yelled at the last remaining soldier on the line. The man stood to run around the middle vehicle and took rounds to the hip, stomach, chest, and finally the head. Samir ran.
Rear vehicle, get in. Keys in ignition. Go.
Samir's sprint put him at an angle that made the fire from the house ineffective. He heard the Americans' bullets eating up the two cars between them, chewing through metal and glass, their trajectory deflected on the way to their target.
Allah, protect me.
Samir put the Mitsubishi Pajero in drive and stepped on the gas. Chapter 43. Reese heard the gunfire from inside the house and knew immediately that Tuvia and Shiri were on the Galils.
Fortune favors the bold.
Reese continued his advance, taking down two more of the attackers and seeing another drop to the deck. He rushed to the base of another large tree as the PKM fired at him again and then switched its attention to the house. Reese moved his head from behind cover to survey the situation. He could see the small SUV racing off down the street, the machine gun on the hillside lighting up the house. That was a long shot for an AK, especially one he hadn't sighted in. He rolled to the prone at the side of the tree. The AK magazine made it difficult to fire from the ground, so Reese canted his body along with the weapon.
Maybe this will distract them enough for Tuvia and Shiri to get to cover if they are not already there.
Reese pushed the AK selector to the bottom position and then came back up one to go on full auto, sighted in as best he could and pressed the trigger, letting loose with what was left in his magazine. He then rolled to his left and got to his feet.
Run!
Reese's suppressive fire had its intended effect. The machine gun went silent. He sprinted to the side of the road before the machine gun opened up again.
If you can see them, they can see you.
The SEAL could no longer see muzzle flash. He was below their line of sight. The escaping SUV was almost at a turn at the end of the street.
Decision point.
Attack uphill, at an unknown entrenched enemy machine gun position, in the dark, or kill the man at the end of the block. Reese sprinted to close the distance. As the car turned broadside in its turn at just over 100 yards, Reese brought the rifle to his shoulder. He moved to a kneeling position and flipped the selector to semi-automatic. When his sights settled on the driver's side window, Reese pressed the trigger. Second sight picture, press. Next sight picture, press. Reese put 10 rounds through the window and door, the Pajero sucking each one like a sponge of death. The SUV swerved off the road, hit a curb, and smashed into a parked car before coming to a stop. The SEAL stood and advanced on the crippled vehicle, continuing to send round after round into it as he approached. When the magazine ran dry, he twisted the Kalashnikov into his workspace as his left hand grabbed a fully loaded magazine from his pocket. He pushed the new magazine into the mag release, sending the empty one clattering to the street. He rocked the new mag into place, feeling the satisfying click, and reached underneath the weapon to rack the charging handle. The rifle was back in battery. Reese was back in the fight. He fired two more rounds as he continued forward before an RPG flew from the hillside and impacted the second floor of Cherie's house. Reese adjusted in a millisecond.
Prioritize and execute.
He was going up. Sprinting from the street, Reese jumped into a ditch that led toward his new target. He heard another RPG fly. He stopped and turned in time to see it detonate on a different house. Cherie's in-laws.
The kids.
Reese's one free hand dug into the dirt of the hill, his legs burning with the intense output, coupled with the desire to kill. He was breathing so heavily that he almost mistook the sounds of rotor blades for another RPG.
Rhys paused and turned to look into the night. The blacked-out little birds crested the rise behind the homes from off the Bentall Reservoir, climbing to an elevation just above their intended target on the hillside. The agile helicopters were slightly darker than the night sky. Rhys had seen AH-6s on attack runs downrange, so he knew what was coming. He hit the deck as Dash 1 launched a barrage of Hydra 7 rockets at the enemy RPG and machine gun position. As it veered off, Dash 2 opened up with its 7.62 M134 minigun. Rhys looked at the SUV at the end of the street. He could hear the little birds banking in the sky. Well aware of what a man running down the street with an AK was going to look like under the nods of the pilots, Rhys dropped the AK. They still might shoot him, but at least they would take a moment when they recognized that he was unarmed. Without a rifle in hand, he could be a friendly Israeli neighbor trying to help at the scene of an accident. Now he was running at what might be an armed enemy combatant with no rifle or pistol of his own.
Not your greatest idea, Rhys.
Despite all the 7.62x39 rounds the driver's side of the vehicle had taken, Rhys knew that bullets did strange and unpredictable things when they hit metal and glass. As he approached at a full sprint, sure enough, the car door opened. A man was attempting to get out. Rhys sped up, hearing the helo overhead closing in. He wondered if they had shooters on sniper platforms on the sides. More than a few of Rhys's bullets had pierced the skin of the Pajero as well as the skin of the man driving it. Rhys kicked the open door and sent it smashing into the wounded terrorist's head before grabbing him and pulling him from the vehicle and dumping him on the ground. He did a quick scan of the car to ensure he was alone before doing a cursory search of the man on the ground and removing a pistol from a holster on his belt. GSH-18, 9mm. Rhys quickly checked its status in case he needed to give the man more medicine, but one look was enough to convince Rhys that the bullets he had soaked up in their encounter were more than enough to send him to his maker. Blood was already bubbling from his mouth, and as much as Rhys wanted to save him for questioning, he knew all efforts in this case were futile. He saw the man's lips moving.
Arabic?
Rhys knelt at a distance that allowed him to see his hands and the off chance they went for a hidden blade.
American,
the man whispered. He saw recognition in the eyes. They were after me. I was the target. Rhys heard one of the small helicopters land in the street behind him. The man's lips moved again. Rhys heard boots on the asphalt behind him. He heard someone shout in Arabic, then in Hebrew. Rhys leaned closer. This time the command behind him was in English.
Don't move!
Rhys froze, straining to discern the words on the dying man's breath. As the man's eyes rolled back in his head, Rhys heard the words of the Quran.
Judgment belongs to Allah.
Chapter 44. Little birds can land almost anywhere. A Black Hawk is another matter. While the AH-6s continued to dominate the skies, assaulters from the MH-6 that had landed in the street kept an eye on the American as the Black Hawk came to a hover. In a matter of seconds, a fast rope was kicked out and a steady stream of Yamam operators slid to the ground, immediately forming a perimeter as the helo veered off to land in an area nearby that could accommodate it. An operator broke from the perimeter and ran to Reese's position, exchanging words in Hebrew with the men guarding the unknown.
And you are?
He said in English.
I'm James Donovan. I'm here with Tuvia Yatom.
The commander of Yamam held up a smartphone, comparing Rhys to a photo.
Make me feel better and tell me what Director Katz's favorite food is.
Rhys almost smiled.
Cigarettes.
Okay, it's him. I'm Harel, he said by way of introduction. What's the sit rep?
Tuvia is hit. He's in the house there. Cherie Galine is with him. She was hit in the back. Non-ambulatory. House also took an RPG. Kids are at the in-laws. It took two rockets. Follow me.
The Yamam soldiers looked at their commander, who said,
You heard the man. Follow him. Gold, take an element into the house. Medic, get in there. Blue on me. Red, push out and get me a perimeter.
Without the weight of kit, Rhys made it to the in-laws' house ahead of the Yamam. He reached for the front door handle and pushed down with his thumb. Locked. Stepping back, he turned and delivered a powerful mule kick that sent the door flying inward on its hinges. He had never gotten the names of the in-laws or the kids.
"Hello, friendlies coming in," he said, stepping through the threshold.
"Hold up, sir. Let us clear it,"
a Yamam operative said from behind. Reese ignored the directive. One of the rockets had impacted the main level. It was a mess of books blown from shelves, broken furniture, and burning carpet. No bodies. Another rocket had impacted the upper floor. Reese raced up a nearby staircase and into a hallway similar to Shiri's. In a deviation from protocol, he sprinted past open doors to the room that had taken the hit. His heart sank as he saw the hole in the wall, the stuffed animals, the wooden toys. A bunk bed toppled over and smoldering.
No.
Reese pushed himself into the room, reaching down to throw a small mattress out of the way. Nothing. Closet. He opened the door and brushed the clothes aside. Empty. He exited back into the hallway, the Yamam operators having cleared the rooms as they went.
All clear, sir.
Where are they? Reese asked, rushing past them and back to the stairway. Harrell was at the base of the stairs. He held up a hand.
They're okay.
Where are they? Reese asked again, coming down the stairs.
Every house built from the mid-80s on in Golan has a bomb shelter. This one is down in the basement, dug back into the hill. This entire house could get wiped out and they'd be fine.
Let's keep them here until we get a status on their mother, Reese said.
We will keep them in the shelter for another hour or two, just in case.
Good.
They're fine down there, Mr. Donovan,
Harrell said in response to the look on Reese's face.
Unfortunately, this is not an uncommon occurrence. Usually it's Katyushas or suicide bombers. That's life in Israel.
Reese considered how he would feel about Lauren and Lucy hiding in a bunker as rockets rained down on their Coronado home.
Can I see them?
Shiri will want to know.
You can. Follow me.
Abbas Ahmed Marmash lay perfectly still. He had heard the gunfire and the explosions. Had the assault force been killed? Was he the only one left to complete the mission? Abbas pushed those concerns from his mind.
You have been given a gift, Abbas. Now there are more Jews to kill.
He could hear the Hebrew all around, and although he couldn't understand the language, he knew that these were soldiers. These were the same men who hunted and terrorized his people. Abbas's legend would be secure. These were special operators, murderers. They emerged out of the night to kill his people. Most of those Allah called to paradise only managed to take out soldiers at checkpoints or civilians in cafes. Abbas would take the most highly trained among them. His strike would cut deep.
Inshallah.
Chapter 45. Reese fell in behind the Yamam commander as they walked through the now secure home. They passed an operator standing by a door at the top of what opened into a narrow stairway and descended into a basement that contained a washer-dryer and a heating unit. The floor was concrete, with a drain in the middle. Cardboard boxes were stacked against one side of the room, along with a rack hung with clothes.
"This way,"
Harrell said. Another door opened off the cement retaining wall. It led to another cement wall, with the path opening up to the left and then right again into the bunker. There were 7 old army cots, a few stacks of bottled water, snacks, and several toys. Reese's eyes fell to an old FN-FAL rifle in the corner. A red rug ran between the cots down the middle of the shelter. 2 bulbs hung from the ceiling, illuminating the space. An elderly couple sat on a cot watching the older kids lead the younger ones in a game. Beige tiles with numbers were scattered on the floor and on racks set up in front of the players.
"Mr. Donovan, meet Mr. and Mrs. Gartner, Danielle and Safra. And these are the kids. That's Ayelet and David. They are Cherie's kids. And these here are Leah and Shmuel."
Daniel stood and shook Reese's hand, but Safra stayed seated, though she acknowledged Reese with a slight nod. The youngest got up and walked to Reese. He said something in Hebrew.
"English,"
the old man said.
"I saw you in the park today talking to Aunt Shiri."
Reese knelt down. The boy was just 5. He must have been born around the time his father died.
"That's right, I was there," Reese said. "I saw you run. You're fast."
"That's what Aunt Shiri says."
"Well, she's right, you know."
"I'm Shmuel. What's your name?"
"Shmuel." He was a Sam, just like Freddie Strain's special needs son. "My name is James."
"I like that name. and Cherie reads me James and the Giant Peach.
She does she? Reese said, remembering his own mother reading him that book as a child.
What were you doing at the park? Do you like slides?
I do, Reese responded, looking at Daniel for help.
It's okay, James, you can tell him, he said.
I wanted to see you, Reese said, reaching up and playfully tapping Shmuel on the end of his nose.
Me?
Yes, and your sister. Leah picked her head up from the game. I knew your mom a long time ago.
My mom is gone,
the little boy said.
She's not coming back.
Reese's heart was breaking. The toughest part of war was not the killing or the bloodshed. It was the children. It was innocence lost.
I know, Shmuel.
She wanted me to tell you something.
She did? What?
The boy's eyes lit up. Reese looked at the grandparents. Their stern faces warned Reese that Cherie had passed along his message. Reese turned back to the young boy.
She wanted me to tell you and your sister that she loved you very much. She did?
She did.
Want to play Remy Cube with us? I'll teach you,
Shmuel said, grabbing Reese's free hand. I might have to do that next trip.
Your hand is dirty,
Shmuel said, laughing.
When we go upstairs, you can wash it in the kitchen.
Reese looked down at his hand. The blood had dried and turned the color of rust.
Thank you. I'll do that. I need to go, but I'll be thinking of you and how fast you are. Bye, James.
Bye, Shmuel.
Next time you visit, will you go down the slide with me?
Count on it. Reese stood as Shmuel ran back to his game. He waved at the other kids and nodded to Safra, who remained on the couch. He began to reach for Danielle's hand, but stopped and looked at his palm.
Sorry, it's dirty,
Reese said, pulling his hand back. The old man walked with Reese and Harel to the entrance of the shelter.
Gabriel is outside,
the Imam commander said.
He's going to stay there for a while. I'll be back to let you know when you can come out. I'm coming up with you. I need to see my Cherie,
he said. Harel agreed.
And you, young man, he said, addressing Reese. I know that's not what Aliyah told you to tell us. Shmuel wasn't even born when you knew her. Thank you, though, for leaving him with that memory.
The old man struggled on the stairs up to the main level. In the kitchen, he steadied himself on the counter and caught his breath.
Not as spry as I used to be, he said. Mr. Gardner, why don't you wait here?
Said Harel.
We'll go check on your daughter and then come get you.
Daniel took a step and almost fell over. Reese and Harel caught him and helped him to a chair.
I'm okay, boys. Just the years catching up. Even so,
Harel said.
I'm going to send the medic over. Might not hurt to have some oxygen.
I'm fine.
Ephraim,
Harel said to the operator standing by the door to the basement.
Get Mr. Gartner a glass of water. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Harel motioned to Reese to follow him outside. They stopped on the front porch.
Stress, anxiety. We'll get him checked out.
Good. This family does not need any more tragedy.
Let's walk over,
Harel said.
I don't want to ask for a status report over the radio with the troops in there.
He motioned with his head back inside the house.
They've got headsets on, but grandparents and kids can be a perceptive lot.
Understood. Do you have a biometrics kit with you?
Yes, and we are already using it. We'll ID these guys and unravel this thing. A group this size, they got in somehow. Probably tunnels.
An operator approached, whispered something to Harel, and passed him a folded piece of paper. The Yamam commander looked at it, and then back to Reese.
What did he say?
Reese asked, noting the look of concern on Harel's face.
The team is going through the bodies. We haven't found anyone left alive to question. The team on the hill ended up being two shooters, a machine gunner and an RPG man. There was not much left of them. So far, it looks like we have a mix of Hezbollah and Syrian terrorists, probably former Syrian military.
Former?
Possibly active duty, but my intel guy says pocket litter, weapons and gear suggest mercenaries on the Syrian side. Iranian-backed Hezbollah for the others.
Who the hell were they targeting? Reese asked.
Mr. Donovan, who knew you were coming here?
What do you mean?
Harel handed Reese the paper his operator had just given him.
They found it on the man in the car you killed when we landed.
Reese opened the folded paper and found himself looking at his death photo, the picture in uniform that the SEAL team started making everyone take before deployment in case you didn't make it back.
senior leaders got tired of not having professional photos at funerals, so everyone ended up having to take them. No one was happy about it, except the staff officer who had to report on its status to the admiral. Years ago, Reese's photo had ended up on the 24-hour news cycle for a few weeks, and now it was in the pocket of a Syrian mercenary in Israel. They could hear a helicopter begin to spin up as they took the steps down to a stone walkway. An operator approached from out of the darkness.
What?
We didn't want to put it out over the radio, sir. We need to get them to Carmel Medical Center in Haifa. We need Kazivek now, sir.
Roger that. Make it happen.
Harrell reached across his plate carrier and pressed a push-to-talk.
Closer to one. This is Red Lead. We are bringing two non-ambulatory patients to you for Kazivek to Haifa.
I'm going with them, Reese said as they began to run toward Cherie's house. In a moment of confusion that morphed to horror, Reese saw a figure sprint from bushes and enter Cherie's house. Even at this distance, there was no mistaking what he was screaming.
Allahu Akbar!
God is great. Chapter 46. The devastation was enormous. The explosion threw Reese and Harrell to the ground. Ears ringing and vision blurred from what were most likely concussions, they struggled to their feet, both doing a head-to-toe assessment as they got their bearings. As Reese sprinted toward the flames, he could hear Harrell shouting something in Hebrew to his men in the Gartner house. A Yamam operator was on the front lawn attempting to attach a tourniquet to the remains of a leg that was missing just above the knee. Reese stopped and assisted him.
"Go! Go!"
the man said, telling Reese to help others. Reese heard the MH6 rise into the night and join the two AH6s patrolling the target area. The Black Hawk helicopter was spinning. It sounded to Reese like it had set down at the park he had visited earlier in the day. Harrell raced past and into the house. Reese was on his heels. Chaos. Even though the windows and backsliding glass doors were gone, thick, dark smoke still covered the scene, making it hard to see. The curtains and couch were on fire, adding to the haze.
"Cherie!"
Reese yelled.
"Tuvia!"
Reese took a step forward and tripped to the ground. He turned and saw what the smoke had obscured. The torso of a Yamam operator. His rib cage was ripped open and most of his internal organs had been eviscerated by the blast. Reese pushed himself to his knees and was about to stand when he saw something else. As the smoke rose to hit the ceiling and make its escape into the night, he saw a head. He reached for it, picked it up, and turned it toward him. It was just a boy, no more than 15 or 16, with black hair, olive skin, and dark eyes. His head had been severed at the neck, as was often the case with suicide bombers, their bodies tamping the blast outward along with nails, screws, ball bearings, and short sections of barbed wire embedded in the explosive. That outward energy also escaped up and would sever the head cleanly at the neck, allowing for positive identification on a corpse that was otherwise completely obliterated. His expression looked peaceful. Reese dropped the head to the floor.
"Harrell!"
Reese yelled, getting to his feet.
"Harrell!"
Reese said again.
"I'm here,"
the Yamam leader said through the smoke. Reese followed the sound of the voice toward the stairwell, the resignation in Harrell's voice already preparing Reese for what he would find. Reese stood next to the Yamam commander and looked down. If Reese had not just seen them alive just 30 minutes earlier, he might not have recognized them. Their bodies had been shredded by the shrapnel embedded in the explosive vest. It was clear that they had not ended up where they did by sheer chance. Both were on the floor. Tuvia had covered Cherie with his body in an attempt to shield her from the blast. A protector to the end. Chapter 47. Mossad Headquarters, Tel Aviv, Israel.
"Take a seat, Mr. Donovan. Or may I call you Reese?"
"Reese is fine."
The director of Caesarea was dressed exactly as he had been upon their first meeting. Reese realized that just over a day had passed since then, and that he was probably wearing the exact same clothes, as was Reese, though now his were marred by sweat, dirt, and blood. The Tel Aviv office seemed darker, as though additional secrets had seeped into the walls over the past 24 hours. News of the tragedy in Kibbutz Merom Golan had spread quickly. Reese and Katz were both warriors. The time to grieve would come later. Now there was work to be done.
Can you tell me why a hit team from Syria had my photo with them and how they knew where I was going to be last night? It seems to me that only a few people knew my intended location.
Katz opened a desk drawer and pulled out a bright green pack of Noblesse cigarettes. Reese waited, touching the fresh stitches on his forehead, just over his left eye, while the Israeli spy touched a flame to the end of his cigarette, inhaled deeply, and blew the smoke toward the ceiling.
"Why and how?"
the Mossad man said.
"Different questions. Finding the answer to one often leads to an answer for the other."
"Let's start with the how, then," Reese said.
"What do you know about a Russian named Yevgeny Prigozhin?"
Katz asked. "The head of the Wagner Group?"
"Yes and no."
"What do you mean?" Reese asked.
"The Wagner Group, as most in the West understand it, is a private military company. Open source reporting indicates it is essentially a proxy military force used to further the Kremlin's foreign policy interests, from the Ukraine to Mozambique to Syria. But it's more complex than that."
"You mean it's the Russian president's private army?"
"Not exactly, but there is a connection."
Katz took another drag off his cigarette before continuing.
"Intelligence agencies first took note of mercenaries supporting Russian troops in the annexation of Crimea in 2014. From there, wherever Russian interests have intersected with strategic energy reserves, mineral deposits, or precious stones, what we commonly refer to as the Wagner Group has had a hand in it."
"Are you saying it doesn't exist?"
"Not in the way we've come to understand the relationship between governments and private military companies like your Blackwater, or whatever they are calling themselves these days."
"So what is it? And what does it have to do with me and the attack in Golan?"
"Wagner is more than a company. It's a network of mercenaries, paramilitary groups, contractors, and related businesses which make it harder to counter. But there is one man who connects them all. Yevgeny Prigozhin,"
Reese stated.
"That's right. They call him the president's chef, as unlike most other Russian oligarchs, he didn't acquire his wealth through the loans for shares scheme after the fall of the Soviet Union, becoming the sudden inheritor of what had once been state assets. Rather, he ran a restaurant in St. Petersburg that the current Russian president patronized on his rise to power. Soon, Prigozhin was winning government catering contracts to the tune of millions, supplying meals for Russian schools and hospitals. Competition disappeared. After delivering on those contracts, Prigozhin then turned his attention to the armed forces. His first Russian military catering contract was worth north of $1 billion.
"It helps to be in business with the president."
"It does. As the president consolidated his hold on power, so did his chef. Prigozhin began to create companies, putting his wife and even mother at their helms. The catering contracts turned to construction and then to paramilitary services. The Russian president awarded contracts to Prigozhin and was rewarded with large percentage kickbacks into bank accounts and investment vehicles across the globe."
"I still don't know what this has to do with me."
Katz took another drag and pushed on.
"In reality, Wagner is a shadow network of entities that at times can be the action arm of the Kremlin, and at other times a proxy force to further the interests of the Russian president while amassing a fortune for those at the top. Wagner is simply a name to focus human rights activists, journalists, and intelligence agencies. PMCs are illegal in Russia, even though mercenaries connected to Prigozhin train alongside Russian special forces in Molkino in southern Russia. Wagner is a dead end."
"If it's a dead end, why are we talking about it?"
"The name Wagner hits close to us in Israel, Mr. Reese. We believe it originated with one of the mercenaries fighting in Ukraine, a former lieutenant colonel in the GRU, Dmitry Utkin,
who we also know was Prigozhin's head of security. Our sources indicate he was a sick bastard who idolized the Nazis and had something of an obsession with Richard Wagner, the preferred composer of Adolf Hitler. He was last seen 6 years ago at a ceremony at the Kremlin honoring those who fought to annex Crimea. You believe Prigozhin has a connection to the attack in Golan? Have you heard of the Internet Research Agency, Mr. Rees? Isn't that the Russian troll farm that caused so much confusion in the last few elections?
That's right.
And do you know who founded it?
Let me guess, Yevgeny Prigozhin.
Correct. Which in reality means it had the approval of the Russian president. Prigozhin even created companies with the public mission of combating disinformation and what you Americans like to call fake news. But as with most things Russian, they did the opposite, leading massive disinformation campaigns to further undermine confidence in Western voting and elections.
They've certainly been successful. I am still not making the connection between Russia and what happened last night.
There wasn't much left of the suicide bombers in Golan, and some of the terrorists took more than a few shots to the head, so facial recognition on them is proving difficult. But of the bodies recovered thus far and entered into the system, four were Syrian mercenaries tied to Concord Management, a company with the contract to protect Russian energy interests in Syria.
As in oil and gas?
Yes, but that's not their play. Russia doesn't need Syrian energy. Russia produces 10 million barrels of oil a day. Syria, only 20,000 barrels.
What do they want?
Access and influence. Russia has not been a player in the Middle East since the fall of the Soviet Union. They are adapting. Russian mercenaries had major involvements in Syria in 2015 and Libya in 2019. As they take territory, they hold it, while Russian businesses linked to Yevgeny Prigozhin acquire major stakes in the exploitation of natural resources. Not because they need oil or natural gas, but so that they can project power from the motherland through Syria across the Middle East into Libya,
putting them on Europe's southern flank, Rees said.
Spoken like a true strategist.
Why risk all that to kill me? To kill Shuri? Tuvia?
That's the question, Mr. Rees. If they were willing to risk their gains in the region to kill you, you must be a threat. A strategic threat.
I'm only a threat to Nizar Khatan. Katz extinguished his cigarette among a heap of similarly extinguished butts in a well-used ashtray.
Peace. Shinbet lost a good man tonight. Your mom will feel this hit for decades. Four children were orphaned. The Prime Minister is considering military action against Syria that could ignite a wider conflict. They are convening the cabinet. The nation is on war footing. Everything we just discussed is circumstantial. The cabinet doesn't deal well in circumstantial. They will call for reprisal.
Unless
we can prove that these were Syrian mercenaries targeting you and not Israel.
That photo should help.
It will, along with the links to Russian paramilitary organizations.
Nothing you've told me indicates why I'd be targeted here, on Israeli soil.
Follow it back, Rees. Your photo is found on Syrian mercenaries in Golan with ties to Russian paramilitary companies run by Yevgeny Prigozhin, a man who doesn't make a move unless it's approved and initiated by the Russian president.
Katz paused, letting Rees process what he'd heard.
Rees, can you think of a reason the president of Russia wants you dead and was willing to risk Russia's strategic position in the Middle East to accomplish it?
Rees exhaled, trying to wrap his head around what he had just heard. I've had some Russian entanglements, but nothing that would justify starting a war between Israel and Syria and losing their recent gains in the region. It just doesn't make sense.
There is something else.
Rees raised an eyebrow.
Information on Nizar Khatan.
Katz said. Is he connected to what happened last night?
He appears to be operating independently.
How do you know?
Rhys asked. The Israeli spymaster tapped his nicotine-stained fingers together, contemplating his answer.
We have an asset in Italy.
In Italy? A spy?
Not a spy. An asset.
I don't understand.
Rhys, what do you know of Operation Wrath of God?
I know you call it Bayonet. It was a reprisal for the 11 athletes killed at the Olympic Games in Munich.
It was, but it was more than revenge. It was an operation to target and decapitate the PLO and its affiliate branches in Europe to ensure another Munich could not happen again. A young Kidon operative was in Europe conducting reconnaissance and surveillance on one of our targeted individuals. Remember, this is a long time ago. There was a wall between East and West Germany. The memory of the Second World War was still fresh.
What happened?
This Kidon reported that his Black September target was meeting with the KGB.
The KGB?
There had been intelligence suggesting that Black September and the PLO had Soviet backing.
Why?
The Soviets were not happy that Israel had taken the side of the Americans in the Cold War.
Was there ever a question?
Oh yes, early on. Israel could have gone either way. The kibbutz movement had deep roots in socialist ideology. When it became clear that Israel and the United States had allied, Israel became a target of Soviet aggression through proxies. The Soviets supported Iran, Syria, Egypt, Libya, Hezbollah, Hamas. Their support of our enemies created the modern Middle East.
But Russia wants back in.
That's right.
And the operation in Germany? Rhys asked.
The Kidon operative was given the green light to take out his PLO target and the Soviet handler. But he took a bullet, a sniper's bullet, before he could execute.
What does this have to do with Nizar Katan?
The man who was shot in Germany survived but never returned to Israel. Nor did he cut ties completely with his former employer,
the Mossad.
Kizaria, Katz corrected.
I'm still not making the connection.
This former operative, there is another reason he didn't come home.
Oh?
He couldn't operate anymore.
Why not?
The bullet nicked his spine. Since 1986, he's been confined to a wheelchair.
Chapter 48. Rhys's flight out of Ben-Gurion Airport was not until the following morning. The two State Department representatives from the United States Embassy had picked him up at Mossad headquarters and driven him to one of the flats they maintained in Tel Aviv. Though the embassy had moved its official address from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the United States still maintained a robust staff at the Tel Aviv embassy branch office. The flat was just off Rothschild Boulevard near the Norman Hotel Tel Aviv and within walking distance of the Independence Hall Museum. Ben-Gurion Airport was not far away.
I recommend Port Said for dinner, the well-dressed man in the passenger seat said. It's less than a five-minute walk. Try the steak with tahini and tomato tartare. It's fabulous.
Maybe these guys are State Department after all.
There's also a deli on the corner that's not bad. Fast Wi-Fi.
I'll keep that in mind, Rhys said, though he had no intention of leaving the flat. He needed to clean up, he needed a drink, and he needed to think. The man in the passenger seat handed Rhys a small gray SKB hard protective case.
Dip pouch delivery, he said, and here's the key to the flat. Third floor, 302. It will be more private than the hotels. Fridge is stocked and there's an assortment of new clothes in the closet.
The driver's eyes were hidden behind oak leaf shades, but Rhys could tell by the slight movements of his head that he was constantly scanning, ahead, to his right and left, rear view mirror, side view mirrors. DSS? GRS? Definitely a former operator.
We will be here in the morning to pick you up. Your flight is at 10, so we will be here at 6. If there is anything you need, please do not hesitate to call. My cell is on the card, the passenger said, handing Rhys a business card embossed with the embassy seal.
Rhys looked down at it as he exited the vehicle and stepped to the sidewalk. Chad Harmon, Embassy of the United States of America, Foreign Service Specialist.
Thanks, Chad.
Rhys looked at the driver, who gave an almost imperceptible nod as he continued to scan. See you in the morning. Rhys was filthy. He'd cleaned up the best he could at Mossad headquarters, where he had received a few new stitches, but he was still noticeably in need of a shower and a change of clothes. He avoided the elevator and instead made his way to a stairwell, where he took the stairs two at a time until he entered a third-level hallway. The key turned easily in the lock, and Rhys entered the flat, locking the deadbolt behind him. Though he was exhausted, it was not quite time to let his guard down. He needed rest, but first he needed to clear the rooms. The former SEAL did a primary clearance, setting the gray case on the couch as he passed. He then went back to the front door and went through the spaces more meticulously. I need a weapon. It was spacious and modern, with good views for a third-floor residence. Rhys got the impression that it didn't get much use. There was a kitchen, a spacious living room area with large glass windows, a small balcony, and main and guest bedrooms, both with ensuite bathrooms. Everything was decorated like it was staged for a real estate brochure photo shoot. Rhys hit the lights in the kitchen and living room and pulled the curtains closed across the windows. No sense in making it easy on an enemy sniper. He then went to the kitchen, where he opened cabinets until he found the glasses. He grabbed three.